Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks so much for listening. Very fun show today. Two guests. First up, Andrew Marchand, sports media columnist from the New York Post. Talk about latest sports media news, including Marv Albert's retirement, what happened with Chris Webber in TNT, NFL schedule stuff, and Kenny Mayne and ESPN parting ways, and a bunch of other topics with Andrew. And then following Andrew, if you're into late night, especially if you were into late night during the Letterman, Leno, Johnny Carson days, there's a great docuseries currently going on CNN called The Story of Late Night. Bill Carter is the executive producer, and he was a New York Times media critic for a long time. He's on the show to talk about the history of late night TV. Really enjoyed it. So that comes after Andrew Marchand. Before we get to it, just a reminder, if you missed any past episodes, last week, Rich Eisen, Alan Sepinwall on the pod. 2 weeks ago, Ryan Russillo and Brian Baumgartner. So if you missed them, check them out in the archives. And if you can subscribe, that helps tremendously. And also rate and review. All right. Here's Andrew Marchand to kick off this week's show. All right. Joining me now, SI Media podcast regular, New York Post columnist, reporter, covers sports media better than anyone. A lot to talk about, Andrew Marchand. Andrew, how's it going?
I'm good. Thanks, Jimmy, for having me.
My pleasure. Lots been going on here. I want to get into Marv retiring and the Chris Webber situation. So there's a lot going on there with TNT. I'm going to start with something, though. It's a little in the weeds. Might turn some people off, but I need to know what's going on, and you're smarter than me. So yeah, so maybe you can explain it. For sports fans listening, what do sports fans need to know about the merger between Warner and Discovery Plus? How will we be affected?
Yeah, in the time being, not that much. It really won't affect you because, first off, it's going to take a year and a half for it to go through. So it's going to take a long time before it actually goes through. And it seems like the regulatory system will probably let it go through, but you never know. So that's number one. Number two, how does it impact you? Well, eventually, you could see the combination of Discovery and HBO Max coming together, which, for example, hockey eventually, as part of their TNT deal, will have an extension onto HBO Max. And so for example, with something like that, you might be getting some hockey with your subscription, but you could see where that's going. That builds out where, you know, direct to consumer becomes a bigger part of, you know, domestic sports in the U.S. Becomes a bigger part of their packaging. Discovery is big internationally in sports. So that's where it is. That in the near term, I don't really think that much because Turner's already locked up the major rights to baseball and then now hockey. They already have the NBA. And so in the near term, not that much.
And don't forget AEW Wrestling. There was a big announcement just now that it's moving from TNT to TBS, and they're going to have another show on Friday. So it's doing well for that company. So it's a player in the Turner world, for sure. I know you're not into it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. The wrestling is big, and that was a big deal. Now, it'll be interesting to see when those wrestling numbers will probably dwarf the NHL numbers, I think, on that Wednesday, you know, regular season-wise, and maybe not playoffs, but that'll be an interesting number. You're right. It's done super well.
So before we get to Marv, what exactly happened with Chris Webber?
So number one, I think Turner had thoughts about making a change with Webber in the recent past before the pandemic. Then the pandemic happens. You're not going to make a change at that point. So there was sort of unhappiness, you know, with him. And I don't have this 100%, but I'm not sure he loved doing the games necessarily. I'm not positive on that, so don't take that to the house. So you had those two factors, and then his contract was up. There had been no contract negotiations, generally speaking. If you're a number one analyst at this point, you'd be at least talking and exchanging some numbers if you're going to be back. And so then I wrote a story saying that Webber might not be back. And after that, I think it was said to Chris, you know, that's the plan. Either you can do the playoffs or not do the playoffs. And I think he chose not to do the playoffs at that point, knowing he was a lame duck. And so I think that's how it basically went down. I think Webber has more potential than others perhaps do. I know he wasn't that popular on social, which doesn't really matter in a lot of respects, but people do look at it in the industry and executives look at that kind of thing. But I think he had potential. You know, we'll get to Marv in a moment, but you know, Marv is the best ever, but he hasn't been at his pinnacle for a couple of years. And so I don't know if that probably hurt Weber a little bit.
Doesn't matter, but also might matter more than anything, social media, when it comes to announcers. Well, yeah, I mean, listen, Chris Weber and TNT parting ways is not really a big deal or even that significant a story. It's the timing of it. I mean, how do you do 99% of the season and then bail? That's what makes you think there's something nefarious going on.
Well, I do think they weren't thrilled about the NCAA tournament, which I've written. You know, he bailed out late. Reggie Miller, you know, he and his wife had a baby. He was out of the tournament, but then it was the last minute timing. Look, from what I've been told, that wasn't the tipping point. I don't think that was great form. Like, if you're not going to do it, people can understand it. It's a pandemic. But to say it so late, it was noticeable when CBS and Turner announced they had their big media press call. Generally speaking, they always have like who's going to be the announcers, right? Because you have a lot of lead in time. And they didn't announce who was going to be doing the games. And so that was kind of a tell. So I don't think that helped him. I think this would have happened regardless if he had done the NCAA tournament or not. I think this is where it was headed, but that didn't help.
So now who do we know who's doing the Eastern Conference Finals with Marv on his last days as a NBA announcer?
Yeah, we don't know yet. I mean, you obviously Reggie Miller will be, I would think, the top choice there. Could they add someone? They are high on Grant Hill. I'm not sure he's going to be able to do it. You know, obviously people weren't putting their schedules together to have this. So I think Miller will be there, I would think. But as of we speak, that's not set in stone. Grant Hill worked with Marv on the play-in game the other night. And so maybe he'll work with him in the early rounds. But in the Eastern Conference Final, I think it could be Miller and someone else.
Now, you've been on top of the Marv retirement for a while, and you had written at one point early on, it looked like Turner was going to give that job to Brian Anderson. Then I think that sort of maybe backed off of that a little bit, and then it was up in the air. Where do we stand now with a Marv replacement after the Eastern Conference Finals this year?
Yeah, David Levy, who was the head of Turner, that was his plan to have Brian Anderson move in there, be the head of their MLB play-by-play, and then NBA. That's kind of been, I mean, I think Anderson's a candidate, but I don't think he's the leading candidate. Kevin Harlan's been there a long time, does a good job. He's a possibility. And then they also have Ian Eagle, who's now in the Turner camp as well for a few years. So he's a possibility. So when you look at it, you know, they're going to have to figure out, you know, who they think is the best person for the job. I know you've written you think Harlan should get it. I mean, I would say Ian Eagle's a better NBA play-by-player overall. So if you're going with the best choice, I think it's Ian over Harlan. But I could see why you go with Harlan because of the longevity. You know, he's put in his time with Turner. So you can understand it that way. He's already doing Thursday night. So you're adding the All-Star game and the conference finals. I do think it would be a mistake if Turner doesn't kind of make someone their number one. I think there is something to having someone on the marquee and not just do it closer by committee. I get why you do that financially, perhaps to save some money. But I don't think, to me, if you're Turner and you're saying where the marquee sporting events are happening, you need to have that marquee crew who you're saying is your number one, even if you have three strong play-by players.
Yeah. My whole point about Harlan is Ian Eagle obviously is as good as it gets. If he got that job, no one's gonna complain, and you know, there's no reason really not to give that job to Ian Eagle. My point with Harlan, you know, Harlan I think is 60, Ian's 52. Let Harlan for 3 to 5 years get a little run here as a top guy. He deserves it. Been calling the NBA since he was 22, and Ian will get that job eventually. I mean, Ian even, you know, down the road might end up at ESPN replacing Breen at some point, because you can believe it. So, I mean, Breen's got a lot left, but at some point, you know, you could see ESPN making a run at Ian, because he's going to be, you know, a lead guy somewhere. I just think, you know, Harlan deserves a little bit of a crack here for a few years, and then let Ian do it.
Yeah, it's a fair point on Harlan. Like, he's an excellent play-by-player, hits the big moments. Again, I mean, look, if I'm doing the hiring in any of these choices, if I'm at ESPN, I'm hiring for the NHL. If I'm at Turner and I'm hiring who I think is the best person I can get. Now, obviously, there's contracts. These things don't always work out. It's very difficult. It's easy for us to discuss a lot of times than to figure out all the contracts because, you know, these jobs don't come up that often. So
plus, interrupt you real quick. Plus, you also, you know, Ian does the Nets. They both do the NFL. There are logistical things involved as well with those guys.
Exactly. So you have to figure that out. But to me, you hire the best person. Like, if you're Turner, you're not waiting around. You say, well, who's the best person for the job? Who's going to make our broadcast the best? And we're not going to have to worry about it for as long as we have this package. I think that's the person you choose. And that'd be me because that's a little like cutthroat. I think, you know, look, it's definitely, all respect to Brian Anderson. He's a solid play-by-player. I think to me, it's a little nuts that he'd be the lead play-by-player on the NBA for Turner. When you have those other, like you said, Harlan's been doing it since he was 22. I don't know how long Ian Eagle's been the Nets person, but I think it's been at least a quarter century.
Long time.
So, man. You know, it's a long time. He's been doing it since his 20s. And Brian Anderson has been doing some NBA, but just the feel you get with games with those two. And I just think Ian Eagle's stronger. Not only does he hit the bigger calls, but he's stronger in terms of the byplay with the analysts. And I don't think it's a coincidence when you look at the Nets analysts, why they all become national analysts. I mean, even Mark Jackson failed at ESPN, went to YES with Ian Eagle. They have a good producers and John Filippelli up top and Frank DeGrace on their games and elevated him. And then Mark Jackson now has been a perennial doing the finals for years and years. I don't think that was a coincidence how that happened. So, that'd be me. But I could see, yeah, you know, the case for Harlan.
No, every point you make is fair and legit. I think Ian and Harlan are like a 1-1A situation. And what I found interesting is that, and again, you know, it goes back to what you said earlier about, you know, how you use social media sort of to judge these things. I mean, I was surprised because, you know, normally people are ready to just pounce and shit all over you when you post something on Twitter. And I think it was 98.5% in favor of what I wrote on Tuesday on SI.com about Harlan should get the job. That's rare for Twitter. I mean, usually, you know, there were like one or two people who were like, oh, he just screams the whole game. Okay, but I was taken aback by how many people were like, this is the only choice because, you know, most people on there just want to be vicious.
Yeah, Twitter does not usually agree with anything, so that is right. Good for Harlan. I would say Harlan also, he does well on like social with those quick calls. I think you listen to a whole game and the insight and that's where I think Harlan isn't as strong. I'm not saying it's bad. He's not as good as Eagle is when you compare them during a whole game and humor and other things that come along with it that, you know, I'm in the East, so we've seen Ian Eagle on the Nets for years and years. So obviously you get more of a feel for, you know, when you watch more, but that's where I'd say the difference is. So on so, and you know, Ian Eagle's calls, he had one the other day with the Nets, where those go viral. I think he was trending maybe. And, so look, they have some good choices that they can make there.
I mean, I want Ian to get that job, but my thing is let Harlan, you know, it'd be great to hear Harlan do a Western Conference Finals for, you know, 2 or 3 years and give him that. Let's get into the Kenny Mayne situation. Usually we disagree, but you had the right take on it throughout about the days of, like, you know, the SportsCenter anchor just being able to live a lavish lifestyle thanks to the salary he makes or coming to an end, basically, from what we've seen. Outside of a Van Pelt situation where, you know, that personality anchors an entire show. But 61, regardless of the salary, whether he was making 100,000, a million or 500 million, a 61% pay cut is a little bit insulting, I think. You don't see it that way?
We're like loaded question. No, I do see it that way. Of course.
Well, what do you want? You want me to ask stupid questions, or I'm, you know?
Well, no, it was loaded in that you assumed that what I was going to say. You said I don't see it that way. I didn't say anything. Anyway.
Well, I'm just saying you were quick to point out he was making 1.5 million.
Yeah, 1.5 plus million.
Right, that was your report, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Right.
It was my report.
So to me, the salary is irrelevant when you're asked to take a 61% pay cut.
I tend to disagree.
It wasn't a loaded question. I knew your answer, and I was setting you up to give your spiel on why you're wrong.
I wish we could rewind and see what you said exactly. But irregardless. The fact is 61% is saying we don't really care if you stay or not. We want you.
We want you to leave.
It's saying we want you to stay at our price. Can you be happy with a drastically reduced pay? But that said, you could argue at this point, Kenny Mayne was, you know, after 27 years, was being paid way too much for what he did. Remember, he only works half the year. He's on he's doing 150 shows. That's not 225. That's 75 less. So maybe a little more than half. They're going to cut that even more. So he's making $10,000-$11,000 a show. So they're offering, doing the math that he gave with the 61%, that he said to, I think, Richard Deitch from The Athletic, that 61% down, that would be $800,000 that they're offering him. Yes, that's a lot less. It's still a lot of money to work half the year. So I can see it, why he'd be insulted, and I could see why they would make that offer too when they're cutting salary. And here's the thing. I see a lot of people, social media, saying, you know, how can I let Kenny Mayne go? I'd like to ask a lot of those people, did you know when Kenny Mayne was going to be on? You had no idea when Kenny Mayne was going to be on. That doesn't mean you don't like him. That doesn't mean he doesn't have value. I do think he has value. If you like Kenny Mayne, you're watching a game, and then SportsCenter comes on, it's Kenny Mayne, maybe you stay around longer. There's definitely value, and there's value for the SportsCenter anchors. It just might not be the 1.7 value. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars, and some people maybe even at a million still for the SportsCenter anchor. It's just not that crazy. I mean, 1.7, or Jamel was making 2.5. You know, that's I don't know if they're getting there.
Yeah, I do think I wrote this too. I do think the Kenny Mayne thing is sort of a nostalgia. There's a lot of nostalgia involved there from the old SportsCenter days that a lot of us love. Again, if ESPN paid him the 1.5 million at some point, that's on ESPN. I mean, yeah, now they want to make a market correction.
100%.
Right. And they want to make a market correction, and they have every right to do that. But you'd think they treat him a little bit better than 61% pay cut. And then here's the other thing too. If, you know, I don't know what the situation is. If Kenny wanted that schedule, or if ESPN wanted Kenny had that schedule. I mean, if the argument is that Kenny, you know, ESPN should be using him more, I agree with that. I mean, he should have been more of a face of ESPN. Now, I don't know if that's Kenny who didn't want to do it, or ESPN didn't want, you know, it's, you know, they certainly, you know, when they want to make Mike Greenberg the face of the network and pay him an extremely large salary, then, you know, it all happens to work out there.
Yeah, 100%. Look, Kenny Mayne should make as much. Yeah, Kenny Mayne should make as much as he can, and I'm all for a number of reasons, guys and girls making as much as possible. That's great for the whole industry and for what we cover. Makes it even more interesting, you know, quite honestly, because of these salaries. And secondly, so there's nobody's fault. I mean, you know, John Skipper is the one that kind of made these salaries go up to where they did, where there are some cases, you know, FS1 came in at one point that kind of ballooned salaries. And I'm all for that. It's just, some of them, I think when you see what they actually are, and then you see like, where's the value for getting 27 years, which you're getting raises, and Kenny Mayne is definitely, you know, he's got to be in the top 10, at least, of all time sports centers. Again, not necessarily my favorite sports center anchor. I heard he's a good guy, and he's okay on the air. Just not necessarily my type of humor. You know, it's just fine. It wasn't bad. It just wasn't
more of a Mike Greenberg humor kind of guy.
I'm more of a Craig Kilborn. He's the Don Mattingly of sports center anchors. 4-year run that was like Hall of Fame run that never, there's some others. I'm not this is going to sound like a knock on Kenny. Kenny Mayne's very good. I think Dan and Keith did this where they changed how you say home run, and Kenny Mayne did it fine. And then like, there was just like, after a while, everyone was trying to have like their home run call. And it's just like, dude, just say it's a home run. I don't need like some made up thing that you're just trying to say home run. That to me, not that funny or interesting after a while. So, and that's not Kenny's fault. Like, he was fine. It's nothing against him. Yeah. But that's just for me of when I was watching the highlights. And also, listen, there's the bigger thing that we're kind of haven't talked about is that SportsCenter, while still important, while still a part of ESPN, is not as important in the media right. and sports sphere. We can just all get the highlights right. whenever we want on our phone.
I think that's really what the ultimate point here is. I mean, you can say that the Van Pelt Sports Center is a sports center. It's not. It's the Scott Van Pelt Show. That's basically what that is. Yep. The Kenny Mayne thing, I think, is just more about the fact that, you know, Sports Center is not, you know, at the top of the list of sports fans on where to go get sports information or news or highlights or anything. It's just, you know, and it's nobody's fault. It's the way everything has changed in the media landscape.
100%. So then you add all those things in and you come at 61%. Here's the thing that's insulting for Kenny Mayne, and where your overall point about like they're telling you we don't want you is if they come at 61%, he counters and they counter again at 40%.
And there was none of that.
Then,
right?
Again, that's a cut. There's a lot of ESPN people taking these 40% cuts. They have nowhere else to go.
Right.
And so they're taking them because it's still better than what they can get on the market. I mean,
there were no negotiations like that though with Kenny, right?
No. So this was we're not getting rid of Kenny Mayne, but in some respects, passive aggressively you are. So you could argue that. The thing I would ask you, in an ideal world, how old is Kenny Mayne going to stay on SportsCenter? 65? Retirement age, we think, like 65 to 61. So it would be right. one more contract, basically. Maybe, you know, all right, you know, it's 4 years, maybe it's two more. You know, most of these are usually two or you know, 3 year deals, whatever. But let's just say it gets him to 65. All right, he gets out at 61, a nearly 3-decade run. I mean, these things just don't have, this is how it ends. Like, this is how it always ends in life and for most people. It's just like at some point, this type of decision is made. And so, you know, but I think when the guy's making 1.7, it's not like we're like, this is out of nowhere and it's Cry Me a River time, you know, it's or some kind of end of era. He wasn't doing like the lead sports center. Like if Van Pelt was leaving and they offered him a 61%, then it's like, you know, get the sirens out because ESPN is really like, this is like, they have no money. That's not what happened.
I think it's a nostalgia is a big part of this. And I think for a lot of people who grew up when SportsCenter mattered more than anything as a sports fan, and Kenny Mayne was one of those people that brought you the news and the highlights every night. You, even today in 2021, you want ESPN to want to keep Kenny Mayne, and they clearly did not. That's really, I think, what it comes down to.
Yes, I mean, but you could argue though, $5,000-$6,000 per show, you still want to keep him. You could argue that. I'm not saying I agree.
I'm saying,
take the history out and what he was making before out of it. But like that's if I told you he's making $800,000. If I told you Kenny Mayne was making $800,000 right now at 61, doing 120 sports centers a year, so half the year he's working, you think that's a good salary?
I'm not as hung up on the money as you. I mean, cry me a river if you're ESPN and you're overpaying someone. They're running a business. Oh, yeah, I understand that. But I'm not going to sit here and I don't sit there and oh, my God, ESPN's paying Kenny Mayne 1.5. That's outrageous.
No, who cares? You know? Hopefully he gets more than that. But they have Disney. They have their overlords at Disney telling them they want them to cut. So you have to cut. Like you can't. So it's like, yes, right. I agree with you. But when you have Disney telling you they want you to cut in a pandemic, then you have to make decisions. Like, that's the reality of situations. Could they pay Kenny Mayne? Yes, they could pay anybody. They still ESPN. Is making a lot of money still. It's not ESPN is not going out of business. If they wanted to pay Kenny Mayne, they definitely could. They didn't want right. to.
Well, I don't want to get into this, but that's also, you know, when that news comes out that, you know, ESPN's asking Kenny Mayne to take a 61% pay cut, then there are the disingenuous people who use that as a way to say like ESPN has no money or they're losing money or they're going out of business, which is a whole other thing that is bizarre that just continues to go on. But forget that. Speaking of ESPN and sort of cutting ties. It didn't get a lot of attention because it's baseball, I guess. But I thought it was interesting that, and it was old news, but it became official this week where ESPN from now on, well, after this year, I guess, they're just going to do Sunday night baseball and that's it. No more games during the week. I guess they'll do opening day. And I think the stupid, the home run contest and then just Sunday night baseball from now on, which I know we're going to the streaming world and people probably on a Wednesday night aren't watching like, you know, the Braves and Cardinals on ESPN, but you know, I think baseball could use any exposure it can get. I think that's sort of not a great deal there for MLB. What do you think?
Baseball wanted to be on ESPN during the week. Like you're saying, but let me ask you a question, Jimmy.
I don't blame ESPN for doing it. Go ahead.
Well, exactly. When's the last time you watched a game on ESPN during the week? You're always watching the Yankees.
Well,
right. And even if the Yankees are on ESPN, do you watch the ESPN broadcast when you get, not Sunday night when it's an exclusive, when there's a simulcast, you can see a yes or ESPN, which broadcast do you watch? I know you listen. Of course.
Yeah. That's not even an issue. Yeah.
So I guess the question is, why would you have these midweek games if they don't mean anything for you?
Right. No. I will, because baseball is the beautiful thing about, I got into this with, Rich Eisen last week about streaming and all this. That's the beautiful thing is you can flip around. I mean, yeah, I'll watch the Yankees, but in between innings or when a pitcher is taking 5 hours in between pitchers, I can flip over to ESPN. And if, you know, Mike Trout is at bat or if there's a, you know, some guy's throwing a shutout, then, you know, maybe you tune in. But yeah, is it appointment viewing? No. Am I sitting there at 7 o'clock first pitch on ESPN on a Wednesday night? No. I get why ESPN did it from the standpoint of, you know, who's watching these games. But also the flip side of that though is, you know, ESPN is in the content business and there's still nothing better than sort of live sports to fill some content. So I don't know, maybe they couldn't work out a price with MLB or something, but again, when I saw the news, I didn't think of it from the ESPN standpoint. My thing was for Major League Baseball, not great that, you know, you know what I do like? Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
You well, go. 100%. And the other point I would make though, and this is a larger point, Jimmy, and you've said on Twitter, so I don't want to say you're not that old, but you've said I'm old, right? Have to look at where the habits of younger people are going. And you mentioned the Mike Trout at that. Well, what young people do is they don't wait. They don't want to see the moment in the moment. Not as important, you know, in terms of what they're growing up in. They will see the moment after the moment and right after the moment. So Mike Trout hits a 500-foot home run. It's on Twitter, Instagram, everything, 5 seconds later. So that's the new flipping the channel. They, you know, and they're on TikTok, whatever, flip. So they don't necessarily watch that way. And so, yes, but your larger point, and this is where these leagues and networks and everyone's trying to figure out, is how to wall off their content. So they're getting paid more, you know, from the fans and viewers, but at the same time, reach the mass audience. And so, yeah, for baseball, you're right. There still is an intrinsic value to being a national distributor with baseball and ESPN. But for ESPN at this point, they are more wanting to be a place where you look for the biggest and most marquee games. And then that old ESPN, what you think of, is now ESPN Plus. You want tonnage? You want to see every single game? Well, try, you know, go to ESPN. But they don't have every single game, and that's going to be hard for them to and they might be able to, and they're spending a lot of money to try to do it, but to try to have that tonnage and you could go and find it. But that's the difference for viewership too. It's about finding things as instead of just coming up on something when you're flipping. So, and that's, you know, changing habits.
I got you. Fair. I thought the NFL gave ESPN a good Monday night schedule. Not great, but good, better than they've had. Sunday night on NBC is so loaded, as always is. Did you have any initial thoughts about any network getting shafted, any network getting a good deal, anything from the... We'll get into this specifically week four Sunday night with Brady against the Patriots. But besides Brady and the Patriots week four, did anything stand out in the NFL schedule for you?
Yeah, I mean, Fox lost that game in theory because that's where it naturally would have been because it's in an AFC Stadium, old school rules. It's kind of changed now, but AFC Stadium with Brady going to New England. So I thought they recovered pretty well having Brady versus New Orleans leading into the I think it's game three of the World Series. That's a late window game with that New Orleans-Tampa game. I don't know. I'm not like every network's always thrilled. I think if you look back and looked at Sean McManus's quotes over the last 10 years, every year it's like the greatest schedule of all time, like Juan Antonio Samaranch and the Olympics, you know, saying the greatest Olympics ever. So I don't think that, you know, so, but I guess it seemed to me everyone did have some nice windows, but the biggest thing, there's going to be injury. There's going to be this, that, and the other thing that changes. And the big thing I would say, the big difference though, and I think it's a plus for ESPN. I know you like that opening Monday night doubleheader.
I do.
If I'm ESPN, I'd rather have that. If they get two good games on that Saturday that have playoff implications, that seems like a nice change for them.
Yeah, that's fine. I like the doubleheader, but the Saturday thing will be great. Because you know what they're doing for the first? They're going to have Saturday games in week 18, which they, yep, and that'll be great. My favorite thing of all, I love the two games on Christmas Day. I love Christmas Day, two NFL games. Then the first one's a good one. It's
Cleveland Green Bay.
Green Bay. Yeah, so that'll be good. Give me, it's May 19th, so this is very important and scientific. Give me a prediction now. Week 4, Sunday night, NBC, Patriots, Bucks, Brady back to New England. Will that be the highest rated Sunday night NBC game ever?
I'll go yes.
I was going to say yes, too. I thought we'd disagree, but we got an agreement.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, here's the thing. Obviously, we have injuries. You know, it could change if Brady's hurt.
They only need one person to play. And their injuries don't matter. So just
Brady's
one person
healthy,
needs to play.
I think they were smart. I mean, both teams probably should be good, but get that game in relatively early. So regardless, you know, I think Tampa, you know, is going to be great this year. I think New England's probably going to be good. But irregardless, you go into that game, they're probably, I'd have to look at their schedules, but they probably have at least a couple of wins. So maybe even, you know, winning record, maybe both are defeated. I think a monster number, Brady going home, he and Belichick, they should be, Belichick will be great on that topic, going into it, you know, just waxing poetic about Brady. Just kidding. You know, he'll probably be, I'm worried about people on my team, all that BS he'll do. But the easy answers to go with the over, but the other question is, Jimmy, I have to know what was the highest rated game in Sunday night in football?
I don't know, but that will
be. I'm saying yes. I'm doing a Chris Russo where he goes, I don't really know anything about this subject, but let me give you my big opinion on it. So I don't really know what the highest rated ever, but I'll say yes, just because
the correct answer is yes.
Yeah,
doesn't matter what it is. Yeah, for a regular season game.
Okay.
I mean, Brady will bring in so many fringe fans and fans who don't care about the NFL that it will be impossible for them not to have the best rating. Before we wrap, how excited are you for the 6-part Derek Jeter documentary on ESPN?
I'm probably not nearly as excited as you are.
I'll just say this. Nobody loves Derek more than me. And when I saw that, I was like, six parts? Really? Six?
Yeah, I think, look, there's
two, maybe.
I would have written this during the Jordan thing, but it just didn't feel like the right time. We're in a pandemic, you know, people are getting sick and dying, and it's just like, we don't know when this is going to end, and Jordan doc comes out. So I didn't really feel like the time to write. But you know what? This Jordan doc, you can really enjoy it so much because he has, he's part of the production of the editorial side of it. And so we're really not getting, the way they did Jerry Krause, I get it. Jerry Krause was supposed to be a tough guy to get along with. I get it. It was terrible at the end that he broke up the dynasty. But two things with Jerry Krause. Number one, him breaking up the dynasty helped Jordan's legacy more than anything, because then Jordan never lost. He probably would have lost. He would have lost eventually if they kept it together. That's what happened. He wouldn't have won forever. He wouldn't still be winning today. He would have eventually lost. So Jerry did him a little bit of that. The other thing is, Jerry Krause took Phil Jackson out of nowhere to be a Hall of Fame coach and maybe the greatest coach of all time. He was coaching the Albany Patroons in the CBA. Jerry Krause also found Scottie Pippen. Now you could say, well, he's going to be a top 10 pick. He went out and got him. So you look at Jordan becoming a champion, they gave Krause a little bit of run, but the idea that Jerry Krause had nothing to do with those championships or was like a detriment is ridiculous. So that brings me to
Mike, Derek
Anderson Jeter, who I know very well. the idea that Derek is not going to be totally controlling on this, to me, is unfathomable. That it's not going to be, now maybe I'll be wrong, but it's going to be his point of view. And
but
so,
I'll say this. Wait, can I just say one thing? You're 100% right.
No, you keep talking forever.
But really, I mean, are there that many damaging things that aren't going to be, like, we knew Jordan had the gambling thing. We knew he was a dick to people. Like, there's not really major scandals there that Jeter had that ESPN can just gloss over. And I mean, what do you have? That
the idea of these things is to tell us something new. Like, the idea is they're telling us things we don't know or showing us stuff we don't know. When you have the editorial control over it, you're not going to really get the full scene. If they had found out that Michael Jordan...
I think we'll get new stuff for his post Yankee life. Since he's left, we really don't know anything about him or heard anything about. He owns the Marlins, and we know that was, you know, there was a disaster there, and obviously they'll get into that, and that'll be sanitized. But in terms of, like, you know, being a father, and, you know, he's not a big baseball fan. He always said he doesn't like to watch baseball. I mean, there could be some things there. I think that could be new.
Look, here's the ultimate thing about it, all right? I covered the Yankees, not a Yankee fan, never was a Yankee fan, you know, so it's not like for me, like, when you cover them, people make that assumption, you like, oh, you love the Yankees. And I covered Jeter pretty relatively closely, right? Others probably more closely than me, but pretty closely, got to know him a little bit, especially at the end of his career when I was on the beat. And he's not going to show you sides he doesn't want to be seen. So, you know, and will he open up more? I think there's a chance he might. He did that final year. He was a different person that final season. He gave me the, you know, top five movies, which might sound stupid to people, but he never did that. And he told me about how he sneak in the movies in Tampa in the middle of the day and watch. That was something he never did. And he gave more time and was more open that final season. And he is into marketing himself. That final season, he was marketing himself for his post-career. I think, I always say this, people always ask, what is Derek Jeter? For me personally, I found him politely aloof. So that's who he is a little bit. But the idea that he shouldn't have it, first of all, anybody can have a documentary. People are like, he's not Jordan.
I don't mind him having a doc. I'm just saying six parts is a lot, even for me. It's a huge.
No, and I think, but I think he's interesting. And I also think the idea that he's not one of the greatest players of all time is ridiculous.
Well, yeah,
let me say one thing about that. I know this is a media podcast, but, like, people who only believe in sabermetrics and all this stuff and don't watch the games, like, Derek Jeter did get more opportunities. He was a Yankee on a dynasty team, but these moments actually happened. So it's like all these things, that these incredible clutch plays, like, is he clutch or not clutch? Is that a thing or not? Whatever. I don't know what the answer to that is. All I know is that Derek Jeter actually did these things. So they count. Just like Tom Brady, you know, I can make an argument he's not the greatest quarterback of all time. He's had the greatest career of all time. So, you know, we can go subjective. So Jeter had one of the greatest careers of all time, and he's like sixth all time in hits. So I don't understand how you can't say he's not one of the greatest of all time. Does he deserve all the gold gloves because of, you know, the statistics? Maybe not. But bottom line is, he's interesting. He's not on the Jordan level, but he's a great player, and he was in New York and the Yankees. He has all the ingredients, and his career was storybook.
I have nothing to disagree with you on, so I'm just going to let you let it all sit there. You said it all, and I appreciate you coming on and defending the honor of Derek Jeter. we were in agreement way too much on this podcast, but it was good. I appreciated it.
Yeah, and, I mean, you got a couple right this time. What can I tell you?
Yeah, Kevin Harlan to replace Marv. That's the mission.
Huh?
All right. Andrew, appreciate it. New York Post sports media columnist and constantly breaking news on Twitter. So check him out. All right. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much, Jimmy. Be well.
Take care. All right. All right. Joining me now, I'm very excited about this. Wrote for the New York Times, covering TV and media for a while. Now CNN analyst, executive producer of a great docuseries on CNN right now, The Story of Late Night, Bill Carter. Bill, thanks for doing the podcast. How are you?
Great to be with you, Jimmy.
I was a huge, huge fan of The Late Shift, the HBO movie, which was based off your book.
Yes.
And now we've got The Story of Late Night on CNN. There have been three episodes. I believe there are two left. I wish there were more. Three left. Okay, perfect. Six total. Yeah. Okay, good. And I've really enjoyed, I've watched the first three. I've really enjoyed it. I've always been like a late night guy, which, you know, is kind of a weird thing to be now because late night isn't really late night anymore, I would assume you get into in maybe the last episode.
Absolutely. Yes.
It's interesting because I've heard James Corden say in interviews before, I remember him specifically saying this to Howard Stern about, you know, he doesn't really do the show for CBS. He's doing the show for YouTube at this point. It's amazing to see what's happened to late night in regards to that.
He specifically talks about it. And I did an accompanying podcast where he talks about it a lot, that his show, he doesn't think of as being late at night or even at night because he has to think about who else is seeing it at a different time. And he always thought that even when he started, because he thought it's 12:35 in the morning, you know, you can't really expect people to watch, although they certainly watched David Letterman at that time. But I think he went into it thinking it's a late night is not a time period. It's a brand. Do you know what I mean? That's really what it is.
Yeah. I remember in that interview with Howard, he said, like, think about how absurd it is to put a show on at 12:30 at night. Who's watching that? You know? So my introduction to late night, I mean, I remember Johnny as a little kid, and I remember my parents being very into Johnny.
Right.
But for me, the two things were Dave at 12:30 when I got into, like, you know, middle school, high school, you just couldn't believe what you were watching. Right. And then I became a huge Arsenio fan, and I was really glad with how the Arsenio thing was sort of covered in the right. story of late night on CNN, yeah. because Arsenio really, really messed stuff up for Johnny and basically everyone else in late night, which you sort of forget about.
He opened doors. I mean, that, you know, Johnny, who I think was a pretty progressive guy and booked a lot of black performers for sure. I mean, you weren't getting, you weren't connecting to black audiences much with Johnny. And Arsenio just came in and shook that whole world right to its shoes. Mm. And, you know, his show got, you know, pretty good response for quite a while. He got it caught on a strange vine because he had become a syndicated performer, and CBS was doing so poorly was because they tried Pat Sajak and that failed. So all these CBS stations signed up for Arsenio, but then CBS hires Letterman and those stations come back to CBS and he doesn't have coverage anymore. So he should have run for much longer than he did.
Yeah. That was what was always a little bit weird about the Arsenio show is that it was syndicated. It wasn't tied to a network. Yeah. But the I remember when I mean, it's so long ago, but I remember the end of Arsenio feeling so weird. It just sort of, it was so hot, and then it yeah. didn't take long for it to then go away.
No, and it's surprising that, you know, he eventually resurrected Late Night Show many, many years later.
Yeah, yeah.
It was too late, really, to capitalize on it. But when he was hot, he was so hot.
Yeah.
The real weird thing is that Fox started their Late Night Show with Joan Rivers. And they had a network show. And when she failed quickly and they got rid of her, they threw in some substitute hosts, and one of whom was Arsenio. And yeah. Arsenio started to really click for Fox, but he'd already made the syndication deal. So Fox couldn't retain him. Now, if Fox had retained him, and I think in the back of Arsenio's mind at the time, he thought he was better off with syndication because the money in syndication was phenomenal, absolutely right. fantastic. But he probably would have been better off on Fox because Fox grew to be way more powerful as a network. And right. he could have stayed on the air for a really long time, I think.
That's interesting, yeah. And one of the great things I should have mentioned at the top about the story of late night, it's every Sunday night on CNN.
Yes.
Like I said, I'm not old enough, luckily, to remember Jack Parr, who was on The Tonight Show before Johnny. But I loved learning. I never knew that the guy walked off his own show.
Yes.
I mean, we dream of that today from a content standpoint. We'd love for, you know, Jimmy Fallon to walk off The Tonight Show. But, like, you know, I would love to know what that was like back then in terms of media coverage.
It was crazy. It was gigantic because he was in his way as big as Carson because there was nobody else doing it at the time.
Right.
And Parr really put The Tonight Show on the map. So he was really huge. And this really puts in perspective how big he was. How many guys can pull this? Walk off the show, basically in the middle of a show, leave your network with nothing for a month. He was gone for a month, and they had to replace him, and they did not fire him. They didn't fight. They made an agreement to bring him back. That's how big and important he was.
Well, that's what
that
I love about
really
the
extraordinary.
Right. I that was so interesting to me in the docuseries. I loved learning about that. So it's not, if you're listening to this, you know, you get a little taste of some great stuff before all of the hosts that sort of, you know, if you're my age or younger, you know. Now the Jay Dave thing was always like I said, I love the late shift.
Yes. Thank you.
So I was always under the assumption that NBC chose Jay Leno to replace Johnny instead of David Letterman, just because of Dave's sense of humor, acerbic personality, obviously wasn't in love with network executives.
Right. But
what we learned in the documentary, it might've been in the late shift, and I may have just forgotten it. Whenever NBC had negotiated a contract with Leno while Carson was still host, there was a clause in there that Leno gets the Tonight Show.
Only the last time. They put it in his contract the last time, not up till then. And what was amazing about it was only, I think, 9 days before Johnny announced that he was stepping down, that they renewed Jay as the guest host and put the clause in there, not knowing it was going to come into effect. So it gave them no chance to go to Letterman and set this in motion in any way.
So my question is, did nobody know that clause was in Jay Leno's contract in terms of media, in terms of Dave, Johnny? Did nobody know?
Not until I wrote my book. Nobody knew. No, nobody knew.
Wow.
And it was done in, completely done in secret, because Letterman thought he still had a chance. He could fight for it.
Right.
He could fight for the show. He had no idea. He had no chance whatsoever. And what the documentary didn't fully capture when his producer, Robert Morton, tells the story of NBC's people coming to Dave to explain to Dave, they want him to stay. Dave gets up and walks, talk about walking out. He walked out of the meeting, but he stood up and he said, "Gentlemen, this is completely unacceptable to me." And walked out. But it was for nothing. He couldn't do a thing. He was boxed in. However, and you'll learn this in the next episode, there was a last minute potential rearrangement, because NBC was not totally sold on Jay, and they were really afraid of Dave leaving and going to CBS, because no competitor had ever taken a franchise to a challenging position with The Tonight Show, and he was the guy capable of doing it.
Obviously, it's famously known that Dave wanted The Tonight Show. Do you think did Dave want The Tonight Show? Did he want to be on 11:30, or did he want to be the person to replace Johnny because Johnny was his idol? What was the attraction, biggest attraction for Dave?
It was clearly that he had grown up as The Tonight Show being the franchise. That's the late night franchise.
Right.
And when he started, he developed a relationship with Carson. I mean, you know, Carson obviously liked Dave. He was not a fan of Jay, but he really liked Dave, and they did have a relationship. And Dave kept that in the front of his mind. And there's an interview with him in the show where he says, "It was in my head. Do not do anything to step on Johnny's toes. Never do anything to step on Johnny's toes." He was totally respectful. Just, "I'm doing the work. Look how good I am. I should be hired." That was his approach. He had $1 million penalty in his contract if he didn't get The Tonight Show, which described by his producer as tip money for NBC. but he wanted The Tonight Show because it was the show that he grew up, you know, revering. It was the show. And then Carson became the guy that he held in the highest esteem. So it was his dream. And it was his dream when he first became a stand-up, because Meryl Marco told me in The Late Shift, his girlfriend / head writer, that the first time she met Dave, the first conversation she had with Dave, he said, I want to host The Tonight Show. And she thought, well, this is nuts. How could a guy have that kind of ambition? Right? That's how badly he wanted it.
I mean, Dave is at such a different point in his career now, but do you think there's still even a little part of him that hates the fact that he never got The Tonight Show?
Well, I you know, there's a scene at the end when it's not in this episode, it's in the final episode, I guess, when Dave is signing off on his last night, right? And it's his last night, and his first joke is, "Well, looks like I'm not going to get The Tonight Show." So it was playing out in his head.
Yeah.
Was it all a joke? I don't know. It was a good laugh line, but I think it was in his gut. And he certainly felt like he'd been cheated. Like he put in 11 years of incredible, tremendous comedy at 12:30, and he didn't get the show. But, you know, I got to tell a little story. So in the last episode, you see an NBC executive named Rick Ludwin. And Rick Ludwin says, you know, Dave was becoming difficult to deal with. He was unnecessarily rude, not just to me, but to other people at NBC. And are you asking me, did that factor in my decision? Oh, yes, it did. Well, the incident that he's referring to, it is a specific incident, because after every one of Dave's anniversary shows, they did a big party in New York, right? And Rick Ludman would go to that party all the time. And there was an NBC executive who was the executive in charge of the Letterman show. She just would be there each night. And she loved the show and she loved Dave. And she was always invited. But this year, Dave was really pissed at NBC. So he disinvited Rick Ludman and he disinvited Sissy Biggers, who was the executive in charge. And Rick Ludman was so pissed off at him for doing that to Sissy. He was so pissed off. He said, this guy is so rude that in the last minute, he kicks her out of a party. And incredibly, that came up even at the very end when NBC is reconsidering maybe taking Dave Tonight Show. It comes up. Will you, you know, we want to make sure you won't be having parties and kicking. And they can't believe there's millions of dollars on the table and the future of the show. But it comes down to a party invitation. It was really important.
And I'm sure you'll cover this. I would assume you'll cover this. But, you know, obviously, then Dave beat Jay a lot until the Hugh Grant thing on the Tonight Show. Did at any point before the Hugh Grant thing, did NBC ever consider getting rid of Leno?
They didn't consider getting rid of Leno because there really wasn't an obvious choice at that point. I mean, they'd installed Conan in the 12:30 show.
Right.
And he was having a very rough time at first. So they had tried a lot of other people for that job, and they all said no. Gary Shandling and Dana Carvey, they'd all said no, I'm not doing that. So they didn't have an immediate option. But they did acknowledge to me when I was writing The Late Show, before the switch with Hugh Grant was when the book came out, Jack Welch, who was the head of GE, I interviewed him, and he said, you know, we made a mistake. Okay, we made a mistake. The other guy's a bigger talent. We made a mistake.
Yeah.
But what people forget is that, yes, the Hugh Grant thing was huge for Jay. Jay started to get a little better. I give him full credit for this. He wised up a little about his performing style. But the real thing that happened was CBS had a disastrous
primetime
situation with its NFL cup. Oh, they lost the NFL, and they lost a ton of affiliates, ton of strong stations. And going from big station in Detroit to some little UHF station, that really hurt Letterman. Yeah. Big, big, big time. So
that was 94 when Fox came in and took the NFL from CBS. Yeah.
Very big, crucial move.
It is amazing. But I mean, obviously now that stuff's pretty relevant, but back then how it all tied together, you know, you have Sunday football, people are watching you late night. If your prime time's no good, they're not watching you late night. Now, obviously you watch anything whenever you want. It's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
The Johnny stuff. Now, clearly Johnny seemed to be one person on TV and one person not on TV. And
Most of these are.
Yeah, for sure. There were a couple of things I mean, we all know the Joan Rivers story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't blame Johnny maybe for being pissed that he never got a phone call. But how do you hold that grudge for your whole life? At some point, you got to move on. You're Johnny Carson.
Look, she handled that really poorly. I mean, let's face it. Johnny had made her career, really, had made her career.
But I don't want to interrupt. But one of the fascinating parts of the series, which I want listeners to know, is there's a clip of Joan Rivers saying that an NBC executive had told her she'll never, ever be the host. She'll only be a guest host. So you get it from her standpoint and why she wants to jump ship. But you got to let Johnny know you're jumping ship.
And frankly, knowing the situation, knowing the people involved, if Joan had said to him, Johnny, I'm not going to get this, but I have this offer from Fox. It's a lot of money. Johnny would say, you got to go with that. That's for your career. You got to go with that. But to do it without telling Joan, he just was personally offended. He had a personal relationship with her and he was personally offended. Did he overtly tell guests don't go on the show? I've never heard that it was formal like that, but everyone knew he was completely pissed at her and had cut her off. And then they said, well, I'm not going to do Joan's show. Maybe Johnny won't like that. So it really hurts.
Once she loses her Fox show and then her husband commits suicide, like,
unreal, isn't it?
Can Johnny make a phone call and patch it up? You know, just from a human standpoint, forget late night, forget TV, you know.
Yeah, I agree that might have made sense. I have to tell you, I found that whole section very emotional. not just with Melissa Rivers, the daughter, talking, but the scene when Joan comes on with Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, like, yeah.
You know, she didn't just get on the Carson show, got on no show.
Right.
She didn't get on with Leno ever during his entire run. And she didn't get on with Conan ever. She was banned from NBC. Never mind, of course.
Right.
So it was really emotional.
And I don't think Dave had her on the CBS show for a long time. he ended up having her on a lot in the later years, but I think when he first got there too, he didn't have her on really.
Well, it was a big black mark for people in the business that she had pulled a move that they just didn't think was right. But, you know, I have a feeling, and I'm not a guy who says misogyny determines everything, but I have a feeling if a guy pulled this move, let's face it, Jay was accused of all kinds of nefarious stuff, right?
Yeah.
Going around days, but he wasn't banned from things like that. It really was pretty extreme for Rivers.
Yeah. Oh God, I just had a thought about the Joan and it went right out of my head. Oh, with Letterman, there's a great, if anyone hasn't seen it, there's a great clip of Joan Rivers on Letterman from one of his last couple of years on CBS where she says some joke and he just walks off in a joking way. And then she does like an interview with herself. And the woman at that right. point is probably like 70. I mean, it was amazing to see her do that on TV. The other thing about Johnny, I found interesting, maybe you could shed some light on this. He wanted Dave to take the 12:30 show and Johnny created the 12:30 show and it was all in his contract. He gets to create it or so he
got a piece
Dave,
of it too. He got like 5% of the show. Something
there
like
you
that.
Go. Yeah. So he creates the show and Dave, and he wants Dave and he gets Dave to do the show. But then Johnny had all these rules for Dave about no monologue, no, yeah. I mean, even down to no horn section in the band. So yeah. I don't under, like, is Johnny that much? First of all, is that Johnny or is that some executive pulling that? And like, why would you
want to be Johnny? I can't believe an executive would care about a horn section. Yeah. But look, here's the thing that's very interesting about this. If you look at the way that whole second late night show has evolved, and usually they try to install someone who's not really a threat to the guy. Like Conan is not a threat to Leno when he's hired. There's no way he barely is performed in his life. And Dave went through a succession of guys. He had a deal with Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart had come off a syndicated show and his company signed Jon Stewart in full anticipation that he would get the show. But Jon Stewart would be a threat at 12:30. Let's face it, right? I mean, Dave went on for years and years, and he would even say he was mailing it in toward the end. If you had Jon Stewart there for 10 years, you would have created, hey, when is it Jon Stewart's turn? So give Johnny credit. He was willing to take this hot young comic and put him in after him, right? And, and then but he didn't want him to do the same kind of show because he wanted there to be a real distinction between the shows. And frankly, as Meryl Marco, the head writer, said, was, we didn't want to do that. Well, that's great. Fine. Right. We want a rock band. We don't want a horn section. We want a rock band. And Dave did what he called opening remarks. Well, that was a monologue, really.
Right.
Something funny. And not having a sidekick on the couch. He just talked to Paul on the bandstand. So it really didn't alter anything. It was just a way to sort of say, we don't want you to absolutely do our show.
I mean, listen, part of the reason people love Dave, part of the reason I love Dave and always love Dave is, you know, he does have that curmudgeonly, you know, can't be bothered with the world type of attitude and is not a fan of compliments. But when you see the people now, especially Jimmy Kimmel, Conan O'Brien, I mean, it's all about Dave for them. Yes. And I hope at this point in his life, he appreciates that.
He does.
Okay.
Those guys who have, you know, come to the feet in supplication of Dave. He knows what he meant to them. He does. And he has great respect for them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have to say the clips that were in the last show, I've seen a lot of those Letterman clips 20 times. They always make me laugh. It always makes me laugh when he does the GE handshake. That's just hilariously funny.
Yeah.
And the scene with Cher telling him off is phenomenal. And it's something I didn't know, which was in the show, was that the censors make a choice between what they would cut out.
Right.
It was really priceless.
Yeah. I think it was his executive producer said that NBC went to him and said, you can either cut ass or hole, but you can't have asshole, but you can keep one of the words in the.
Yeah, because that's what Cher called him.
Yeah.
Dave said, great. Well, you didn't come on because you thought I was, and she says, an asshole.
Her delivery on that was fantastic. Too.
Yeah.
There was something else I wanted to ask you about Johnny. Let me ask you about Jay. So I was never a Jay guy. I never got it. Anytime I watched it, I didn't get it. I never ever once laughed at anything he said. So
even
maybe
when
I'm coming.
He was a guest with Dave.
I thought because that was, even I then I just thought the though. Jokes were just so hokey and hacky. Like it was just not. I'm more of the Dave dry, you know, it's a totally different.
It is.
But I get why Jay appealed to so many people.
Yes.
In that, you know, weird sense of humor way. My question though is, and maybe I'm coming at this, looking at it not fairly, but I get the impression that Jay sort of tarnished his image in that whole thing with Conan, and then the 10 o'clock show, and then he got the Tonight Show back from Conan. And then there's been some recent controversies, I guess. Something else. Has he tarnished his image at all, or is that just me not liking Jay?
I mean, clearly Jay has been hurt in the long term by some of the decisions he made.
Yeah.
The jokes are about Koreans and things like that, which are really play poorly now. And the whole thing about Monica Lewinsky, which was over the top.
When I watched that, I could not believe it, even for back then.
It was over the top. But Dave was bad on that, too. But anyway, but Jay made a conscious decision. When he was on with Dave, he was the outraged guy and all this stuff. And he came across, he was dressed in, you know, motorcycle jackets and stuff, as a rough-edged kind of guy. But to the Tonight Show, you got to be the sort of, you know, button-down suit guy. And he was perfectly willing to do that. And he could do that. He was able to do that because he believed in the setup joke form of comedy, which Dave did not do. Dave was conceptual comedy, much more idea-driven than joke-driven. But so Jay had an enormous audience, and he consciously in his head thought to himself, I can win this way. I can win in the ratings this way. Mm-hmm. And the Dave people would say, yeah, you can win in the ratings, but you're not going to have a long-term great image for this.
Right.
And it's played out this way. It has played out this way. I made this comparison, and it's kind of obvious, but you know the movie Amadeus, right? In the movie Amadeus, there's this guy who's a sort of the hack composer for the emperor. And at the time, people think he's great because he maneuvers well. But the other guy's Mozart, you know, and longer term, everyone remembers Mozart.
Right.
And no one remembers the other guy. And this is what's playing out for Jay. Maybe Jay doesn't care. He will profess to not care.
Right.
He won the ratings. He gave the network what it wanted, et cetera. But you can't go into the comedy business and have virtually anyone say, oh, yeah, I modeled my career after Jay. He was my inspiration. That doesn't happen. It's all about Dave. It is all about Dave.
A couple of quick things before we wrap it up, because I've enjoyed this thoroughly. Like I said, there have been 3 episodes so far of The Story of Late Night, so catch up on those on demand, and 3 more Sunday nights on CNN at 9 o'clock. And if you're a fan of late night and TV, it's so worth the watch. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. Obviously, we haven't gotten to the later episodes, so I haven't seen what you got into with the current crop of hosts.
Right.
I don't know if you can answer this as a critic, but do you have a favorite right now who does late night?
Well, that would be crazy for me to say that.
Okay.
I would say I like these guys. I mean, I have good relationships with these guys. Mm. I have to say Jimmy Kimmel's one of the best guys I've ever known, period.
Right.
I mean, he's just a great, great guy. Yep. I mean, I think Colbert is a brilliant guy. Brilliant, brilliant. What he did on the Colbert Report is now so spectacular. He did a sketch for 9 years. He was a character. That was... I didn't believe he could possibly do that.
It's almost like you forget about that. That's how good he is now. You forgot that he was a character.
So good at that. And when he hit on that show, it was gut-bustingly funny. He really was. And he's learned how to do it. He had a lot of trouble transitioning to himself from the character, which we get into. That's bizarre, but he did. So I think he's very talented. Jimmy Fallon is a hugely talented guy. He can do things nobody else in late night can do. His impressions, his singing, all that. Is he the kind of comic that some people like because he has no edge? That's probably his flaw for some people. I think he obviously has a strong appeal because he's a very talented guy.
Yeah.
I think Seth Meyers is very talented. I think James Corden's stuff is brilliant. Some of the stuff he does is crazy artistically brilliant. And the new ones that are coming along, like Amber Ruffin and Desus and Merrill, they're really good, really talented, fresh voices.
My thing with Fallon is he needs to calm down when he's doing the interview with the guest. That's where he loses me. Forget the humor. Just calm down. The fake laughing and falling out of the chair. And I'm
he's
a big Kimmel.
He's performing, and that doesn't work in it. Don't perform in your interviews.
I'm a big Kimmel and Corden guy. You mentioned earlier Pat Sajak having a late night show.
Yes.
Give me someone who had a show. I mean, there's been so many people who've had late night who've come and gone at Chevy Chase and Rick Dees and
Magic Johnson. People.
Yeah. Is there one you thought wasn't that bad that ended, like, who did you think got a raw deal or you think could have grown into the job or you would have liked to have seen it maybe go
a little
on.
Bit more of it?
Yeah. It could be nobody.
I mean, I think most of the people who've not made it have not made it for a reason. And they're, some of them are good, but I mean, Chevy Chase is a funny guy. His show was a disaster. It was a disaster.
Yeah.
Here's a point I'll make, Jimmy. This is way harder than it looks. It's way harder than it looks. I have people come to me and say, what is the big deal? A guy comes in, there's 20 writers. They write jokes from, they put them up on cards and he stands there and reads them. And then he sits next to a starlet and that's the end of the show. And I'm like, you know, this is what the job is. 5 days a week. If you're on a network, you come in, there's nothing. You have nothing. There's nothing prepared usually. And by 5 o'clock, you have to tape a show that's polished and funny and entertaining. That is crazy hard to do on a steady, regular basis. Really, really hard to do. So if you can get there and stick and stick and stick and stick, you have it. You've just got some particular skill. And I admire all the guys who've been able to, you know, do it for 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Last question, and I would assume you get into this probably in the later episode, the last episode maybe, but obviously now the late shows have transitioned now to political. I wouldn't call them political shows, but they are political heavy.
That's yes.
And all of them. There's not one that doesn't do it.
Yes.
Is it just inevitable and the host had to do that? Would you like to, do you think they could have gotten away with not doing it?
Well, this is a very interesting question because Jimmy Fallon got in trouble for not doing it. He right. was trying to not do it because he wanted to be lighter. Johnny Carson always did political jokes and they were great, but it was perfectly, you know, down the middle stuff. He was like chewing on their ankles. He wasn't going for the throat, right? That's really the difference. Donald Trump changed it all because the hosts felt not only that he was generating crazy stuff every day. You can't make up drinking bleach and drawing on a weatherman, all this crazy stuff. Right. And they'd have to throw their shows out at 4 o'clock and do a whole new monologue so often. So it drove them to be very Trump centric. Plus, they thought he was a menace. They honestly personally felt this is dangerous for the country. And they abandoned their objectivity. There's no doubt about it. They were coming from their gut. And that inspired them. That's what they wanted to do. And they felt like they had to do it. And you couldn't avoid it. There was just so much craziness going on. And that, you know, in the past, if Dan Quayle, who was the vice president for Bush, spelled potato wrong, right? That was fodder for 2 weeks of jokes. 2 weeks. They would make right. jokes for 2 weeks. Trump would do something three times a day that they would make jokes. And the craziness from Monday would be gone by Wednesday because another crazy thing would have happened. So yeah. I think they were driven by events. I don't think it will continue. Biden is clearly not that kind of character. Every president has a comic persona. Clinton was a woman hound, you know, George Bush was a goofball, whatever. And Trump was obviously a crazy person. But Biden, he's old. Okay. That's right. That they make jokes about him because he's right. old. So last week they found out he had a Venmo account, right? And they went crazy about this because Joe Biden has a Venmo account? I thought he paid for everything in silver dollars.
Right.
It was like crazy age jokes. So that will be the thing for Biden. He will get picked on for being old, which is perfectly conventional comedy approach. Conventional.
Yeah. And then obviously it's all changed too, because it's all about, like I said, you get the clips going on YouTube and Twitter in the morning, and that's how people are consuming late night anyway. So the whole thing is completely changed, which is what's great about the docuseries is you see how it changed. So I appreciate you coming on. Everyone check it out. It's called The Story of Late Night, CNN Sunday night at 9 o'clock. 3 episodes down, 3 to go. So catch up. It's a very, very fun and enjoyable watch. So, and Bill is the executive producer. So thanks for coming on. And I could have talked to you I could have talked about this forever. So I appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you. All right. My thanks to Andrew Marchand and Bill Carter. Enjoyed both interviews immensely. That late night stuff, I'm into it. So I hope you guys enjoyed it. Hit me up on Twitter if you enjoyed it and you want more sort of stuff like that, because if I'm just doing that for me, it's fine. But it'd be nice if you guys enjoyed it too. All right. Past episodes in the archives if you missed anything. Rich Eisen and Alan Sepinwall last week. Ryan Russillo, Brian Baumgartner 2 weeks ago.
Give those a listen. Subscribe to the SI Media Podcast. And if you can be kind enough to rate and review, that helps too. But subscribing is most important. All right, that wraps it up for this week. We'll see you next week right here on the SI Media Podcast. Stay safe and take care.